temperature is falling, all my winter here is calling. The weatherman has run away, far away. But if I got you with me, doesn't matter if it's getting colder, I'll stay warm my way. Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we're no place to go, let us know, let us know, let us know, let us know.
Oh, yes. Let it snow. It is nice to see a blanket of white this time of year. If Mother Nature won't oblige, then humans step in. Coming up during this edition of Jet Streaming, the art and science of making snow and measuring it.
When we finally kiss goodnight,
I ain't going out in a storm. But if you really hold me tight,
yes, I know it is cold in some portions of the country, and we do have skiers who listen to Jet Streaming. So we wanted to go to Buck Hill in Burnsville, Minnesota, just outside the Twin Cities, and talk about snowmaking. With us to do that, Don McClure. He is the guy at Buck Hill when it comes to making snow. Thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you for allowing me to talk to you here in the chalet versus going out there. It's a little cold today, and I see you have been making snow.
We have. We've been making snow now. We're about 36 hours into it. We got a north wind that just came from the south, and we're making snow like crazy.
How much of this is art versus science?
Long question, short answer. Short question, long answer. It's a little bit of both. The basic concept is very simple. You throw the right-sized particle up in the air, and it crystallizes and falls to the ground. Short answer. Long answer gets relatively complicated with the systems of freezing, humidity, evaporative cooling, convective cooling, how many nucleating sites you have in your water to produce a nucleus for the crystal to grow up on, and all those factor into how a crystal is actually formed. And it's the same thing that happens in the cloud over several minutes or even several hours, but we make it happen in a few seconds.
And how does that occur?
Basically, the process is we have a water supply. We enhance that water supply with a ice nucleating particle. It's a naturally occurring plant bacteria and protein, and it enhances a nucleus formation. Without a nucleus formation, water will not freeze until it's actually several degrees below freezing. People often think that water freezes at 32 degrees, but without a nucleus, it will not freeze until it gets to a much lower temperature, depending upon what source you're using for a nucleus to build that crystal upon.
What can go wrong in snowmaking?
Oh, everything. We look at, obviously, the differentiation in temperature. The colder, the better. We look at humidity, because the drier, the better, because one large factor is evaporative cooling. It's the same effect as when you jump out of the shower and you're wet. All of a sudden, you get a chill. It's because you're evaporating. And that's a big factor in removing the heat from the water particle to get the crystal to form. And so we're looking at cold, dry, and of course the winds play a factor. And we need to blow our machines downwind. And so we watch those three entities very carefully.
Obviously, you don't want a lot of moisture content in your snow.
Drier the better, absolutely.
And that is because... And I'm not a skier. I'm really sorry about that. It just holds the skiers up, and it's just kind of sticky and icky.
You dry the snow, you know, the more resistant to icing, the more air content, the better the grooming. And snowmaking has come a long ways in the 45, 50 years that snowmaking has been around. The early generation of snowmaking basically produced more or less a white ice. And the technology improvements, particularly even in the last 10 years, I mean, we can basically dial in what type of snow we want to make, whether we want to make a more of an airy powder or a heavier base. And as far as managing the snow from a commercial ski aspect, we prefer the man-made snow versus what comes out of the sky, because we don't know what Mother Nature is going to give us. It might be wet, might be dry, might be blowing, might not be where we want it, might be drifting, and we can make what we want.
Have you noticed, with all the talk of climate change that you are, now you just said that you like making snow, but have you noticed you've had to make more snow because of climate change?
What we've noticed is that the overnight lows are not getting as cold as it did, say, 10, 20 years ago. The highs are not that far off the mark, although they are a little bit warmer. And basically what our industry has responded with is bigger, better, faster. Capacities are way up so that when we do get the window of opportunity, we can make a lot more snow a lot more quickly.
Wow. Can you tell the difference, by the way, between natural and man-made snow?
Man-made snow is a finer particle, and natural snow can come in many shapes and forms, and you just don't know what you're going to get.
You and I were talking before we began our official conversation here about you've been here 32 years, right?
Correct.
That's a long time to be here. And is Buckhill one of the very first ski areas in the country to make snow?
We're the first in the Midwest and had what was known as a Largemont system installed in 1961 when the then privately held corporation went public and sold stock and installed the first T-bar lift in 1961 and the first snowmaking system.
And obviously, as you say, it's come a long way since then.
It's come a long ways, even since I was younger, working here in college at night making snow. I could remember at some evenings pumping 75 gallons per minute for the whole system. And, you know, in today's day and age, our minimum flow is about 500 gallons a minute.
Goodness sakes. So you do use a lot of water to do this.
We do use a lot of water in a given day that we'll put up about 3.5 million gallons in a 24-hour period.
I would presume, doing what you do, that you have to keep pretty close tabs on what the weather's doing.
We really do. We've got, obviously, all the websites dialed in the National Weather Service, weather.com, AccuWeather. We're looking at all their forecasts on an hour-by-hour basis, contrasting and comparing them. And then we also have a data transmission networks, DTN system, also known as Meteorologics, which comes on a satellite feed. And we can dial in current radars, current satellite images, other different forecasts. What is the wind doing in Litchfield right now? We looked that up this morning. Let's see what's going out west of here. Is it still out of the south? Is it out of the west? Or is it out of the north? And it was out of the north, so we knew that a lot of the data forecasts that were coming out of some of the other sources, wind wasn't going to change at 2 o'clock. It was going to change about 10 o'clock, and it did. And of course, we were looking at it at about 9:45, and we weren't quite ready for the wind switch. But at least it's better to have 15 minutes notice than none.
Isn't it amazing just how much information there is now available when it comes to weather and climatology?
It really is. I mean, and when you're looking at real time data, there's so much out there, and oftentimes it can be very contradictory. So you've got to try to judge who's more accurate. And then we also look at the regular media, too, the TV stations and the weather stations, and see what tweaks they're putting on their forecasts in comparison to National Weather Service or weather.com or AccuWeather, and try to get a consensus if there is one, or try to figure out our own.
Have you ever had a situation here, Don, where you thought you were good to go and then a wind shift occurred and just really messed it up?
Oh, happens all the time. All the time. Wind is the most difficult to predict. Temperatures, humidities are much easier, but those wind switches can be really difficult.
Sending probably, what, piles of snow into the highway area here, or what?
Well, what we get is that, you know, we like to blow the machines downwind because they're basically big turbine fans, and when you have the ambient wind blowing them, the moisture back into the fan, then we get icing problems and frozen equipment and a mess, and we don't like that.
Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Don McClure is with the Buckhill Ski Area just outside the Twin Cities in Burnsville, Minnesota. I'm going to manage to make it back to the studio in just a minute. Hang on as jet streaming continues. See, you guys, the official start of winter is in just a few weeks, and I'm not a meteorologist, but here's my prediction. It's going to snow. How's that?
Boy,
huh? Pretty
are you
good?
A genius.
Thank you very much.
Accurate.
Thank you. I just don't know how much. That's my problem. Snowfall measurements are, as you two know, a key piece of data for forecasters, but also folks involved in fields like engineering and construction. The state climatologist for the state of Colorado, Nolan Duskin, became distressed some years ago by what he felt was the inconsistent and sometimes inferior quality of long-term snowfall data in the U.S. Nolan and his team have been contracted by the National Weather Service to help test and evaluate and compare snow observations from ultrasonic sensors to the traditional human observers. And I'm really pleased that Nolan Duskin joins us. How are you, Nolan?
I'm doing great.
Thank you. Well, let's go back to this feeling that you're not too weren't too excited about snowfall data in the U.S. How did this come to pass for you?
Well, first of all, as a weather observer, I'm the keeper of the official weather station here at Colorado State University. We've been measuring for 119 years. And what do climatologists like to do? We like to look at trends and variations and cycles and stuff over many years. And I looked back at our own data, which I knew a lot about, and I said, oh, man, it varies a lot in ways that doesn't make a lot of sense. Start looking at the data and seeing that at different times in the past, people have observed in different ways, and the data just aren't always consistent. Then you start looking at data from other parts of the country, and it gets even worse, especially in some of the areas that only infrequently get snow, so the observers don't get a lot of practice. And you kind of get the idea that, wow, we do okay measuring temperatures, not too bad measuring precipitation, especially rain, but when it comes to snow and its water content, kind of a weak link.
Nolan, Paul Huttner here, and I'm looking at one of the sites here on what we call the Snowtell Network. And I'm assuming that you work with these areas, these remote sensing areas that measure snow. And I'm looking at a picture here of one of these sites called Arrow up in the high country of Colorado. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us, for our listeners, what do these sites look like and what do they do?
Okay, well, you're looking there. Snowtell is a system of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have the job of monitoring the snow and the water content from the snow coming out of the Rocky Mountains. And what those sites that you're looking at, well, first of all, for years they sent crews up at the end of each month from about the end of January through the end of April, sent crews up to places all over the high country of the western U.S. to measure what they called snow courses, which are essentially a series of measurements in a given location from which they would measure the depth and then the weight of the snow to determine its water content. Well, that was a lot of work, and it was sometimes scary work. And furthermore, you'd only get data once a month, and as you know, we keep getting more and more impatient when it comes to data. We want it now, and we want it immediately, and we want it from lots of places. And they started in the late 70s to deploy what they called snow pillows. And snow pillows were simply, well, if you were walking through the woods and you stumbled into one of those, you wouldn't be exactly sure what you were looking at, because it was just a flat, kind of a metallic-looking surface. But in reality, it was a pillow full of a fluid, and in that fluid would be a pressure sensor that was essentially working like a scale. And as the snow would accumulate on that surface, it would weigh the snow and send back a signal saying, we've got X number of pounds of snow here at Arrow, Colorado. And you can convert that by a simple linear relationship to the amount of water in the snow. And so that started in the late 70s and has been going on. In fact, every year they put out more and more of these snow pillows throughout the Rockies, and you can track snow accumulation, not necessarily the depth, but the water content of snow through these snow pillows.
That's cool.
Yeah, this is Craig Edwards, and working for the Weather Service in the 1990s when we deployed ASOS, the Weather Service literally walked away from snow measurements at the airport. And I was caught in a position to try to find somebody who would measure snow to keep the historical record going for the Twin Cities International Airport. And believe me, it was like the story of the Little Red Hen. Everybody wanted the snow, but nobody wanted to take the snow.
Yeah, and curiously, many years later, it's been, 12, 13, 14 years, depending on where you are, since they deployed the automated surface observing system at the major airports across the country, and that's still a problem at many of them.
Yes.
And furthermore, the rain gauge, you know, the National Weather Service had a long tradition of doing a reasonably good job measuring precipitation, but when you start automating it, you find out measuring the water content of frozen precipitation has still not been perfected.
Yeah, I think if people only knew the story behind precipitation measurement from the government's perspective, It has not done a good job. Fortunately, we have the backbone of the cooperative weather observers. And you were mentioning you had over 100-year records at your site. And I think that's what's really saving us, because when we enter into the environmental debate of climate change and we talk about snowfall, you really are hard-pressed to find solid data that's longer than maybe 30 years. So I think it's important that we do take advantage of the remote sensing equipment. But I suspect even that has its problems. So could you fill us in on what might be going on with some problems with even remote sensing equipment?
Yeah, and of course, Minnesota is kind of the home of snow remote sensing with the, see if I can get the acronym right, the National Operational Hydrologic Remote Sensing Center there in Chanhassen. And using a variety of different techniques, looking down from above on snow from satellite with a variety of different sensors and aircraft flying over. And all of those techniques, which provide useful information, but they need accurate ground measurements to calibrate, to have an idea what they see when they fly a transect, what do they call those, gamma radiation flights over the northern prairie, and in order to convert that to snow water equivalent, which is what is needed to be able to predict the amount of water that's going to be flowing down the Red River or the Mississippi or the Missouri or whatever, you then have to correlate those gamma traces with the actual snow water equivalent in the snow that's observed on the ground. So it's a fascinating little struggle that we're always going through. The stumble stutter.
That's okay.
the project that we're working with now is using a technology, and of course, every new technology always sounds like it's going to be the best thing since sliced bread, that we'll have it all mastered and we'll never have another problem. The technology we're evaluating right now is using sound waves, ultrasonic depth sensors. They've been around for probably 20 years. They're getting better, essentially sending ultrasound from a sensor above the snow, bouncing it down off the surface, then listening for the return signal. And what do you know about snow? Well, fresh snow loves to absorb sound waves, which is why it's so quiet when you have heavy, fluffy, low-density snow falling. So this sensor works really well when the snow has compacted just a little bit. When the snow is very fresh, the sound wave is kind of dispersed and attenuated. You don't get the clean return signal. But still, it's some useful information. So we're testing that right now at a number of sites around the country. Let's see, Duluth was helping us a couple years ago. They're not in the project right now, but we got stations over in Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, and South Dakota where we're testing. So we got you surrounded there.
So is there a day here, Nolan and Craig and Paul, for that matter, where human snowfall observers, like my dear father, who goes out with his little boule board and measures with a measuring stick, he's not very accurate, I have to say, unfortunately. Oh, my dad's not listening. But do you see human observers in going the way of the horse and carriage someday?
Oh, my. The longer I've been in this business, I think when I started in climatology in the 70s, I might have thought by 2007 that maybe we wouldn't be needing the human volunteer. And now that 30 more years have passed, I see that it's more important than ever before. So, no, I don't think it's going by the wayside. And furthermore, what do we know about precipitation? It varies so much.
Mm-hmm.
It varies so much from one place to the next. One person's in the freezing rain zone 5 miles away. It's in the wet snow zone. Another 10 miles, it's in a low density snow zone. Then you, not to mention the lake effect snow zones and everything.
Absolutely.
Else. There is high variability, and where there's high variability, we need as many observations as we can, whether or not we're trying to spy on this from space.
Well, I think the weather geeks, so to speak, seeing the snowfall posted on a picture And they say, boy, I can't believe they have 7 inches in Fridley and 12 inches at Apple Valley. And and then you fall back to say, how do meteorologists predict that ahead of time when you see the variability in the observation? And I couldn't agree with you more when we talk about the human aspect of measuring snow. If you see it and you can measure it and you report it, I believe it. Until you've proven that you're not reliable. And I'll even believe your dad's report.
Well, you know, I keep saying to him, you got to go out there. Sure, an inch fell, but then he'll let another inch fall on top of the first inch. And then he measures. I mean, he just doesn't.
Okay.
He needs to keep
his heart is in the right place, and we respect that.
This is pretty close to being a rocket scientist, though. I tell you, to being a snow scientist, to try to measure snow at the proper intervals. And the Weather Service has tried to put in guidelines that make it so that it's a uniform measuring of snow. So even when the humans are doing it, you got to do it the right way.
Yeah. Now, Nolan, I see you have a videotape available for folks who want to know more. Things to know about snow?
Yeah. That's a website on the Colorado Climate Center web connection. We do our best to train and educate folks on how to measure precipitation. And we did, under contract for the National Weather Service a few years ago, a video on how to measure snow. And I look younger in that video because it was a few years ago, but darn it, they reprinted a few thousand copies this year, and I think we're still out there trying to help.
Immortalized forever in your youth.
Well, we will put that particular web address on our website, and folks can link to that. I think that might be pretty helpful.
Great.
Nolan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Well, it's fun to talk to you folks.
Thanks, Nolan.
Good luck with your projects.
Hey, thanks.
We've been talking to Nolan Duskin. He's the Colorado State climatologist, and we've been talking about taking more accurate snow measurements. By the way, his website is our weather website of the week. It's www.cocorahs.org. cocorahs.org. I think you can find reference to Nolan's snow book and the snow video. In fact, video can be streamed from the website by clicking on Things to Know About Snow. My goodness, it's probably everything you've always wanted to know about snow, but were afraid to ask. Thank you to Paul Huttner and Craig Edwards for sitting here with me during this edition of Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. Mark Seely will be back with us next week. Until then, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.